United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe. This is the Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain. My guest is award-winning Canadian documentary photographer and filmmaker Louis Palou. He has been a Guggenheim Foundation Fellow and a Harry Ransom Center Research Fellow in the Humanities at the University of Texas at Austin. He is known for work which examines human rights, conflict, and poverty. Publications include La Repubblica, the BBC, Der Spiegel, PBS NewsHour, The New York Times, The Washington Post, NPR, The Globe and Mail, and others. Louis Palou is an artist in residence at the Gettysburg National Military Park. Welcome to the Seminary Explorers.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the installation that you just hung today in the forest. Would you like to
describe? The one I'm recovering from.
Yes.
You know, that installation, just for everybody who's listening, it's a series of 10 portraits of U.S. Marines that I took in 2008 in Helmand Province, Afghanistan. For some reason, that group of Marines I photographed, those portraits, something was inside them, the relationship I had with them, that when I approached publications, they ended up being three different covers of Newsweek magazine. They won a lot of awards, and they started being published and exhibited in a lot of different places. And it became it, one in particular became very well known in the an exhibition at the Houston Museum of Fine Arts called War and Conflict, curated by Ann Tucker, which toured the United States, and it was like one of the iconic images from that exhibition. So I was asked by a photo festival at the University of North Carolina to come give a keynote talk a few years ago at one of their photo festivals. And I said, look, well, why just have me come give a talk? Why don't I have an exhibition? Like, you're paying to bring me down there. So I said, look, I had this idea. And it was to make these large format portraits and hang them outside of a museum, like in a forest, because it's just this nice, quiet place and things are changing and there's sounds. And we did. We hung out at Battle Park at the UNC campus. It really captivated a lot of people because I took them outside of a museum. So I had them down there and I had a plan. One day I'm going to show these again somewhere. They rolled up in my friend's garage and then I got this residency and I pitched it to the park and we scouted out a spot and I hung them today. Sorry, that was a really long answer. Poor editor.
And describe the material again.
These U.S. Marine portraits are printed on sort of a waterproof vinyl canvas. They're over 90 inches in height. They're very, very big. And they're hung using some wire, using sort of the weight of them off trees. And they interact with the shadows of the sunlight and the sounds and the wind, and they move, and they're just kind of sitting in the forest. And it was funny, we were hanging, people were like stopping and looking and asking questions and wondering what these were and why and what the connection was to get the Battle of Gettysburg in the park and Marines from Afghanistan. So anyway, that's the story of the portraits.
And they're near the visitor center.
They're actually on the path from the visitor center up to the battlefield. So if you go to the visitor center and walk up the path, you'll see them on your way to what would be, I guess, General Meade's headquarters or that parking lot.
And this combination, I just keep thinking about how powerful it is. We're on a historical battlefield here. And you're bringing pictures from a conflict that when you took the, you're in an active zone, basically. And there's this, I mean, that's an interesting tension. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah.
Just where they are now here?
Well, I think, you know, especially this site, Gettysburg, and, you know, I think everybody knows the significance of how this battle ended up being a part of shaping this country. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's a protected, preserved park, a place where people can go and see and understand the battle, mm-hmm. and reflect on it and what it means to them. I just feel like history is this kind of thing that we need tools to remember or mm-hmm. think about things. And it's funny that we think that we'd preserve Gettysburg to not forget about the Civil War mm-hmm. as a park, but that we could forget about a war still going right now in Afghanistan that we hear about once in a while in the news and don't hear about so much anymore. And I just think it's interesting to connect the two, mm-hmm. the experience of people in war and how everybody's interconnected in some way. Either you have a relative who's serving mm-hmm. Or affected by war, or a family member who lost, or a friend who lost a child. But I think that it's incredible that we think when we're in the most divided period of this country's history, that we think that all those Marines in those photographs are from states as diverse as Virginia, Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and that the idea of division from because they're from those states is not even a thought, actually. Mm. So I just like the questions and the conversations that those photographs force people to have.
Mm-hmm. This is not the only unusual setting that you've had your work in.
Yeah.
Could you say something about a couple of examples? You have some really interesting formats. I mean, your photographs have appeared in museums and galleries, mm-hmm. And also in public, a very diverse kind of publications, electronic and print. And also some of the installations have been, you know, not what you might expect. Mm-hmm. Could you say something about your choice of not just what the content of the images are, but how viewers are experiencing them.
Okay, yeah. A lot of the way I approach things is because I went to art school. I was kind of like this hybrid, you know. I went to art school, and I became interested in journalism. And it was photojournalism, not just journalism in general, but photojournalism specifically, and how these two things intersected. And I always felt excited by the prospect of them fitting together. Like, why can't a photojournalist have an installation? You know? And I think for a long time, when I was in school and I graduated in the 90s, the artists were like, look, you're a journalist. You're not with us. And then the journalists were like, look, you're an artist. You know? And it's kind of funny that only in the past maybe 7 or 8 years, they've kind of crossed over and overlapped, you know. For some art critics, documentary photography is realism. You know, this is the funny sort of use of language. Mm-hmm. I find that's interesting. Where this comes from is my fascination and love of history and art. And that was instilled in me by hearing my parents' oral histories from the Second World War. They're Italian, so every night was...
They're first-generation immigrants to Canada.
They're first-generation immigrants to Canada. Mm-hmm. They're Italian. They were born before the Second World War. And it was like, you're not leaving the table unless you take your bread and wipe everything clean off the plate. Mm. Don't you know how we grew up? And it was oral history. And I'd always use my imagination to imagine, like... Because we are all fascinated with where we come from. Mm-hmm. It's the eternal part of famous plays like, you know, To Be or Not to Be, all these, who am I, you mm-hmm. know, search for identity. And so because of that oral history, I became really, really fascinated with history. And with art, what fascinated me with art was when I found the Bauhaus, the Bauhaus Art School, the famous art school that started kind of in and around the First World War, mm-hmm. and led up to revolutionizing art and design and how mm-hmm. we use it and how, you know, you can design a teapot or furniture and that's as valid art as sort of a painting or a marble sculpture, and that art is many things, you know. So I really like that, and I love that rebellion, you know. around that same era, that Dada movement, all these different art movements come out and challenge the institution. And I just feel like, why can't I take photojournalism, portraits from a war zone, and hang them in a forest? That doesn't sound odd to me. It sounds like a new way of engaging people. And I used the word earlier, forcing or encouraging conversation and people ask questions. Because I think the greatest part about this country is the ability you can ask questions, mm-hmm. and no one's going to come and arrest you, put you in jail, like some other countries, in context mm-hmm. of the greater world. And so that is how I started questioning, like, why can't I publish my own newspaper? So I did. I published newspapers. I've published three of them so far, one on the Mexican drug war, one on Guantanamo Bay, and one on the identity of Washington, D.C., that you can re-edit. Say, like, at University of Texas at Austin, I thought, I have this work I'm doing with National Geographic. I took these portraits of Inuit and I froze them in ice blocks and they slowly melted and they fell to the ground. Oh. And I just thought, of course I can use, they could be cheaply described as tragedies or just experiential sort of approaches to having people, use art as a tool to ask questions and understand what's happening to the world and how it relates to them.
And also, it's it happens in so many fields, not just art, of course, but this this territorial sense again of kind of making these categories. And it's like there's also this innate human response. I mean, it's just interesting that
Well, then there's also this preciousness around art. Like, you go into a museum, and I just want to say for the record, I love museums. They're still very, very mm-hmm. important. It's important to commit to go to this special building, go inside there, forget about what's going on, and engage with something, painting, drawing, whatever it is. And even if you don't understand it, that's a good thing. Then mm-hmm. you're asking questions, and you're working, you're thinking about something. But I just like these marine portraits, where we hang them, there's like bugs landing on them, and there's a caterpillar moving up one of them, and the water hits it and it pours down. Like, the whole idea of archival art, and conservationists would lose their mind if they, oh my God, the art's getting wet, So I just think that, there are a lot of different ways of engaging the public. And also, you can make take photographs of some of this public art, and the viewers, the audience, can post it on their Instagram. Mm-hmm. So that's another
thing. They're engaging with it then.
Totally.
Yes, and I sometimes it's really very important to see something in the dedicated space of a museum, because you've got the white space, you've got the, you can really focus on something. But there are so many different ways, and the more different ways that you can look at and participate in pieces like this, I think are interesting. Tell us about the church in Amsterdam that you also had an exhibition at, because that was also a really interesting site.
Yeah, so the there's the same work, these portraits of these Marines, mm-hmm. and a lot of the reason why I'm fascinating with these Marines, I took portraits instead of doing reportage, like mm-hmm. sort of things happening on the battlefield, and I just made it portraits that are looking out at you, is that famous Rosenthal photo from World War II of the flag raising of Iwo Jima. Oh, uh-huh. We don't know who any of those guys are. How old are they? Where are they from? And I just felt like it's an important photograph for the time. Mm-hmm. It's not a criticism, but I'm just carrying the conversation somewhere else. Here is this person. Here's their name. This is where they're from, and they're 21 years old, and they've already done a tour of Afghanistan and Iraq. What does that mean? How different is that person going to be when they're 30 or 40 or 50? What happened is there was a call for an exhibition from a museum in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. and it was about war. And I submitted these portraits. Again, people were just fascinating seeing these 21-year-old faces that were in some ways had this layer of what is a very experienced older person because mm-hmm. of the war.
And there are also these frontal portraits.
Yeah. They're frontal, straightforward, mm-hmm. and they're huge, we talked about, I'd been fascinated with maybe printing on see-through material, mm-hmm. like an acetate or a When I say acetate, a lot of people don't look at me like, what's acetate? See-through plastic paper, you know, Mylar, and just because like they're ghosts. Mm-hmm. And it was, those photographs were hung in the ceiling of that cathedral, and it was commemorating the anniversary of the liberation of the Netherlands in the Second World War. I just like the idea that they had this like ghost-like quality, you know. And that was the beginning of this idea of making more large format portraits and hanging them in places. I like those, they're see-through, like there's like a ghost quality to them. And that's where that led up to the banners that I have now here at behind the Visitor Center on Gettysburg.
And I also am really intrigued by installations in spaces, dedicated religious spaces, because the early financiers of artists were, you know, churches, for example. But it's just interesting to see these. An installation is quite different than an altarpiece or windows or something like
that. The Sistine ceiling is the ultimate version of what you're talking about.
Yeah, so it's also exciting to me whenever there are contemporary exhibits taking place in sort of worship spaces, which are not permanent, right?
Yes.
Not commissioned in the same way, but that we can, there's an extra layer of meaning then to the way that we experience them, the way that we see the pieces.
No, and I think that it's important to gauge all audiences in as many places as possible. I almost had an exhibition in a large church. I forgot where it was going to be, but there was a possibility, and I thought of hanging the work. And again, sometimes my ideas are so radical that the idea in my brain is fantastic, but then when you go approach the gatekeeper, they're like, are you crazy? There's no way we can do that.
Yeah.
But the battlefield, the Park Service here loved my proposal right away, in addition to me making some art here, some unique stuff.
Great.
But and doing some public lecturing. And I think that, you know, I like the breaking down of walls that's happening. I don't know if this is because we're in the digital age or what's happening, but you know, it used to be that only installation, there's actually installation artists.
Oh.
You know, they're an installation artist. It's like, I don't know, I thought, you know, making the art, the installation is just another way of presenting it. But I just like how everything's breaking down. Anyone, you know, a lot of people be filmmakers. That's, this installation is a manifestation of that.
And your photos, there's a definite straightforward, I don't know if I should use the phrase old school or not, but even when you have them appearing in sort of unusual places, you're still, it's a straight photo.
Yeah,
right,
totally.
So, and
it's just a portrait, the oldest way of goes back to Roman sculptures, you know. This is who your emperor is, and they put a portrait of the emperor. But yeah, it's a portrait. It's a document. It's an artifact from a time, you know. I wish there were portraits of like Roman legionaries. Like, who are these guys? Yeah. Like, how old were they? What part of where were they from? What did they look like? How many campaigns did they do? And it's not about glorifying war or patriotism. It's just understanding history. What were these people? You know, I think there's a series of portraits a curator showed me of German World War One prisoners. Fascinating. Just like, what did these people look like? How old were they? Like, it just gives you, it peels away and reveals a few layers of an understanding that gives you empathy. And I think that empathy is one of the most powerful things that we should all try and cultivate within ourselves.
Well, and they're individuals instead of just being sort of a group of soldiers.
You know,
they're all individuals.
It's easily label a whole country or place or organization all as one thing when it's many, many moving parts represented by one person kind of leading, I guess, or dictating.
Since you've been here for your residency, what's an example of something that maybe you didn't quite expect, or that you, I don't know, something since you've physically been here in Gettysburg and living on the battlefield that just...
Yeah, so I did have one, and it's in my little talking points. It's horses. So my girlfriend is grew up with horses, and I've always liked horses, but I think I've gone horseback riding more in the last year than in my whole life. And I immediately, when the first day I got to Klingle House, where I'm living in the middle of the battlefield, like halfway almost between the Confederate and the Union lines, my friends joked, like, only you would have a residency in the middle of the front lines of a former war zone. But I looked out the window and I saw, like, I counted them, 17 horses, you know, walk by Klingle House through the field. And I thought, they must have, like, horseback riding tours. So, you know, I looked them up, and I was looking for, in addition to just coming to this residency and having solitude to work on some of my existing projects, I'm working on three here. I wanted to produce some art, which I'm working on doing. I haven't done it yet. I watched a lot of documentaries about Gettysburg, and I had the first, I came to Gettysburg for the first time in 1987 as an American history trip from Canada. We came to Gettysburg Battlefield, and I guess I would have been 17 or 18. So it's not my first time. Actually, I found out I got accepted to college by phone here in Gettysburg. Oh. Yeah, same my friend, art college. On the phone, the letter got to my... That's when you would get a letter, I guess.
Right. Oh, yes. In those emails. Days, that's how it was. Yeah.
Wait, I lost my train of thought. Where were we going there?
The work that you're doing here and a connection to horses.
Oh, yeah, something I discovered. Sorry. Okay. Having watched all these documentaries and looking at lots of books, what really struck me was the statistics first, of course, and and I've already known it, like over 600,000 dead. You know, that's more than almost every war the United States has been in combined. And this is with outdated, you know, like old style rifles that you have to load one shot at a time. So it's very calculated, and there's a lot of effort to kill each other. And then what really struck me was, I don't know where or how I saw it, but in one of the documentaries, they talked about how many horses were killed in this war. And what I found really incredible, and I always try and pull unpredictable things out of how I make art. So I thought, wow, there's three different places that do horseback riding on the battlefield tours, and one uses rescues. What an amazing story that, you know. So I'm going to do something horse related.
Okay.
You know, I don't know what it is yet. I have some ideas I'm working through. Very nerdy, deep photography kind of things I'm thinking about. But yeah, I found this stat that it's wide ranging. They weren't really, the Pew wasn't around to collect the stats back then. By the way, I love Pew. I'm subscribed. Read all the, I listen to C-SPAN. I'm that guy. And it was over, almost double. One figure is 1.2 million equines, you know. I don't know if I'm saying that word right. Horses and or mules and donkeys were killed in the war because horses were integral to having the most sort of efficient advanced army. All your scouting was done by horses. All your artillery, you know, I think the standard cannon and all its ammunition would be 6 to 8 horses.
Yeah.
You kill enough horses, suddenly that artillery piece isn't going anywhere. Supplies, wagon train, food, everything. So, and you can't just, as everyone knows, you can't just go take a wild horse and start riding it. It costs lots of money. So horses were targeted before people a lot of times. And I think it's incredible to think of the slaughter of these animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's these horrible stories of cruelty, like, ride, you know, some soldiers would ride these horses to death. You know, like I learned from my girlfriend, you can't just, like in the Western, start riding this horse, like you got to get there, and you can ride the horse for 3 days, the horse will die. It'll fall down.
It's a living thing.
It is a living thing. But you know, movies, there's these scenes like in Lord of the Rings where they're riding horse like for 3 days straight to get to Elrond's kingdom or whatever. Well, that horse would have died unless it was some special elf horse. But, and I just, that's what struck me. That was the surprise that I'd never thought about, is how animals had been used in war. And in some ways, moving away from sort of these more ancient wars like Roman Empire, where it was swords, and obviously you'd have to use horses to get around back then. But in this, what I would say is one of these early modern wars, where you were using firearms and cannons, the slaughter of horses was remarkable. There were no vehicles really yet. So it's incredible how we cultivated this incredible living thing. I mean, there isn't a cruel shred or cell or bone in any horse. And that how we forced them to be this part of this machine of war and killed them in, mm-hmm. in such vast numbers. So that's my discovery here is, and it's incredible that there's this horse rescue here that, you know, there's these horse battlefield tours with mm-hmm. rescue horses, which is such a positive story. So you don't always find, it's hard to find that covering all the wars I've covered.
That's wonderful. Do you have any other, I don't know, a sort of thought or comment that you might leave us with as someone who has really just seen and mm-hmm. been present in so many situations? And being here now with a little bit of space, and you've got kind of this mm-hmm. this mixture of the project that you do with the horses, yep. the things that you're finishing up, this installation that you just hung that has been in other places.
Well, you know, so I was in Afghanistan for 5 years, on and off. Mm-hmm. No one, to be in a place like that as a journalist, when you have family members at home and loved ones, I went back and forth. But even when you're home, the war is very much still inside you, part of you. You know, I covered the Mexican drug war for 3 years, Ukraine. I've been to a lot of different other places all over the world and seen terrible things.
And also the miners, for example.
Just yeah, like, I know. I covered workers for a long time. Yeah. Yes, it's 12 years under, mm-hmm. you know, and then I did a project on asbestos where I pretty much mm-hmm. would photograph people dying of cancer for six, mm-hmm. you know, and it was like this litany of death and destruction. And I've come out the other side. I still cover these kinds of things. I'm still working on these kinds of projects. And, you know, I don't want to sound naive or like I've lost it and I'm not aware of all the things I've seen, because I'm very aware of it every day in my mind and who I am. It's a part of me. But I'm like the eternal optimist. Mm-hmm. Life is an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we can't ever be in a position where we can't find something positive in what's going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, the very nature of where I'm on in my residency is about that. When people think of hatred and division, I'm not sure the United States was ever more divided than at that pinnacle of the Civil War. Mm, yeah. You know, like really where the country's in some way divided in half. And in some cases, family members and neighbors and loved ones are fighting each other and killing each other. Mm-hmm. And sort of the journey back for the country from that era. So I think that I'm always looking for a solution. I'm always looking for, even if it involves compromise. You know, I thought about our interview today and I thought, you know, there's just so much talk of hatred these days. And I don't know. I find it hard to hate anybody because I've seen what happens when people hate each other, and I've seen the beauty of this country. You know, it's funny when people who are not living in America, or when they speak of Americans in general, like everybody's like a robot and they're the same right. thing. Like, oh, America's such a bad place, or all America, you know, there are these stereotypes. I'm thinking like, how can you dislike Martin Scorsese? Like, he's the cutest little guy I've ever seen. And he makes these incredible films. You know, how can you dislike all the incredible musicians and artists and thinkers, you know? I was fortunate. I was an intern to photographer Mary Ellen Mark. She's American. I mean, you're American. I mean, this, you know, people ask me what it's like coming back from war, and when you experience and see everything going on and the loss of friends and colleagues, mm-hmm. or the terrible things you see other people go through as you're there as a witness, the place that I always find is this moment of enlightenment at the supermarket when I'm in line and people are angry, like, oh, come on. And it's like, I'm just thinking, you take as long as you want. I'm in a hurry to go nowhere because yeah. I'm not walking outside. There's no suicide bomber trying to blow me up. I'm not worried about walking on my lawn with landmines. Mm. I'm not worried about a shell or a secret police or a death squad coming to kidnap me in the middle of the night and I disappear. And I think that, you know, the great part about us understanding all those things is brought to you by journalists and artists and documentary photographers and writers writing books, you know, Joan Didion writing about El Salvador and all these great works about either the Spanish Civil War or the coup in Chile, you know, that film Missing with Jack Lemmon is such a powerful film for us just to remember how amazing things are here. And when we're sitting here in the middle of the battlefield, the Gettysburg Park and the Civil War and the division, I always think we can always come back from anything, you know.
Yeah.
And that's not just a sales pitch line. It's actual true history. It's yes. history. Mm-hmm. So.
Thank you for that.
Yep.
Thanks. And also, you know, it's a privilege to stand in line with your Cheerios and to yeah, not totally. Be in danger and we forget
that. No, and I just think, look, being nice costs nothing. Yeah. It's not... I think helping people is like medicine. Mm-hmm. And if people try it, it's so rewarding. It gives you a sense of purpose and it makes you feel like, you know what? Does it have to always be about me? Can it be about somebody else? It can. Mm-hmm. Like, and it makes you feel good. And so, you know, I think a lot of the veterans who are coming back from the war, finding a sense of purpose where they're helping people has been one of the greatest medicines in at least my circle that I've seen cure people.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. You've been listening to The Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain. My guest has been documentary photographer and filmmaker Louis Palou. Learn more about his work at www.louiepalu.com and visit our friends at the National Parks Arts Foundation, www.nationalparksartsfoundation.org. Louis, thank you for your time.
Thanks.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.